Greetings. Welcome to all listening. Genocide, mass murder, and massacre are part of today's message. Hitler and Stalin have biblical parallels of cruelty. Some of us may have seen the documentary of the 300 Spartans who all fought to the death against enormously huge army, sacrificing their lives at the Battle of Thermopylae to save Greece, while the opposing king, in today's message, sat on his throne watching the battle. Two Bible books are absent God's name. One contains love, the other decreed mass murder. Book Song of Solomon contains love and does not mention God. We'll not talk of that book today. The other book, which doesn't mention God and prayer, demonstrates God's care of his people, delivering them from genocide, and it's not the book of Exodus. Today's book is the only biblical book taking place in what is today Iran. We'll look at three presidents from what's today Iran. President number one is Ahmadinejad. President number two in history is likewise hateful. But President number three is a good man and was likely the author of today's book. Today's book of the Bible is one of two books named after a woman who is not mentioned in the New Testament. Martin Luther said, quote, "I am so hostile to this book that I wish it did not exist," unquote. Today's message is entitled Book of Esther, Four Personalities, 12 Lessons. Esther, Four Personalities, 12 Lessons. In 7 points, we'll look at 1. Background, 2. Haman, 3. Mordecai, 4. Ahasuerus, 5. Esther, 6. Esther, later years, and 7. 12 lessons. Point 1. Background of the book. Point 1. Background of the book. According to PCD letter 259, Esther was probably written by Mordecai. The gap between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7 is filled up with the book of Esther. Let's look at Esther in three pairs of books. Expositor's Bible Commentary tells us the first pair, Esther, is one of two Old Testament books named for a woman, the other being Ruth, and is one of several not quoted in the New Testament. Second pair, Esther, is one of two books that does not mention God, the other being Song of Songs. And third pair, Esther, is one of two that deals specifically with persecution of the Hebrew people, the other being Exodus. Though God and prayer are not mentioned, yet obviously it was before God that the Jews humbled themselves, fasting to seek God's help. Esther contains the account of the origin of the Feast of Purim, one of two festivals adopted by the Jews, the other being Hanukkah. Esther is the only book in the Old Testament in which the entire narrative takes place in Persia, modern-day Iran. Esther has been described as a masterpiece of literature, a literary treasure. Today, the Jewish people hold the book of Esther in highest esteem. More manuscript copies of Esther exist than any other book of the Old Testament, revealing Jewish esteem for it. Esther preserved the account of one of the Jews' rare triumphs over their enemies. In the book of Esther, we see one of the greatest deliverances of God since the Exodus. God's unseen hand guides, directs, and preserves his people and us by working out circumstances, often in the most unexpected ways. God is always there, working behind the scenes. God's hand is guiding us also when we strive to live his way, working out circumstances in our individual lives. Point two, Haman. Today's president, Ahmadinejad, at the United Nations, 17th of September 2005, said Israel must be, quote, wiped off the map, unquote. Canada's then Prime Minister, Paul Martin, was upset. Quote, this threat to Israel's existence, this call for genocide, unquote. In the book of Esther, the Persian predecessor, today Iran, Prime Minister Haman, had anger at Mordecai the Jew and hatred of the Jewish race and resolved to wipe it out, genocide, massacre of Jews. Who is this Haman wanting the Jews' genocide? Josephus and commentaries say Haman was, by birth, an Amalekite. Amalekites were descendants of Esau, also known as Edomites. The rabbis identify Haman as a direct descendant of Amalek. Fawcett says he was of the blood royal of Amalek. Jewish and Christian expositors regard Haman as a descendant of the Amalekite king. The Amalekites had from the first pursued Israel with unrelenting spite, with attack on Israel, cruel, treacherous, and altogether unprovoked. Let's turn to three scriptures. First, Exodus 17, verse 14 to 16. Exodus 17, verse 14 to 16. Then said the Lord, said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. He said, because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Second, let's turn to Deuteronomy 25, verse 17 to 19. Deuteronomy 25, verse 17 to 19. Destroy the Amalekites. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt, how he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear, when you were tired and weary. He did not fear God. Therefore, it shall be when the Lord your God has given rest, you rest from your enemies all around in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess as an inheritance, that you will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. Agag, king of the Amalekites, was conquered and taken prisoner by Saul and hewn in pieces by Samuel. Third scripture I'll read, 1 Samuel 15, verse 2. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy what they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Skipping to verse 33, Samuel hacked Agag in pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. Haman was told that as a Jew, Mordecai had refused the act of worship of Haman, and that the whole Jewish nation thought and acted accordingly. Haman, an Amalekite survivor, would instinctively hate Israel and every Jew. JFB says, Haman knew Jews were sworn enemies of his countrymen, Amalekites, and got the king's sanction of the intended massacre of the Jews. There's also a hidden plot in the story. Mordecai and Esther were descendants of Kish from the tribe of Benjamin and relatives of King Saul. Haman the Agagite was the descendant of King Agag of the Amalekites, who were nearly wiped out by Saul. Haman's goal is the final effort in the Old Testament period of the complete eradication of the Jews. Genocide of the Jews will be attempted in the end time again by Edom. Let's turn to Psalm 137, verse 7. Psalm 137, verse 7. Remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it to its foundation. Haman's treachery led to his own fall, and Haman and his 10 sons were hanged on the gallows Haman had previously prepared for Mordecai. Point 3. Mordecai. Point 3. Mordecai. Subpoint 3A, bow down, bow down. Esther's Uncle Mordecai would not bow down to Haman. Why? Let's turn to Esther chapter 3 and remain in Esther chapter 3 a bit. But Mordecai would not bow down or pay homage to Haman. Mordecai was asked, verse 3, why do you transgress the king's command? Mordecai responded, verse 4, had told them that he was a Jew. Point 3b, divine adoration. Clark commentary says to bow means prostration, which Haman expected divine adoration, implying the highest degree of reverence that can be paid to God or man. The Jews all think Mordecai refused this prostration because it implied idolatrous adoration. Let's notice in Esther chapter 3, verse 2, for so the king commanded concerning Haman. Commanded shows that it was not a mere civil honor and respect. Haman, as king's favorite and prime minister, would have received normal civil honor and respect, and would not have required the king's command. Therefore, the king's command must be something uncommon and extraordinary. Had this only meant civil reverence to the king, he would not have needed to command it, nor would Mordecai have refused it. Therefore, it was some kind of divine honor intended, such as was paid to the Persian kings, and which even the Greeks refused as express adoration. Point 3c, Persian divine worship. Wesley says, probably the worship required was not only evil, but divine, which, as the kings of Persia arrogated to themselves, so they did sometimes impart this honor to some of their chief favorites, that they should be adored in the like manner. That it was so here seems more than probable, because it was superfluous to give an express command to all the king's servants to pay a civil respect to so great a prince, which of course they used therefore a divine honor, must therefore be intended. That a Jew should deny this honor is not strange, seeing the wise Grecians did positively refuse to give this honor to kings of Persia themselves, even when they were to make themselves addressed to them. One Timocrates was put to death by the Athenians for worshiping Darius in that manner. If then Mordecai refused to pay this honor to Haman, the reason of such a refusal must be sought in the notions which the Persians have to combine with the action in the circumstance they regarded it as an act of homage performed to a king as a divine being. This homage, then, was regarded as an act of reverence and worship to a god, which was by the command of the king to be paid to Haman, his representative, by the office bearers of his court. This Mordecai could not do without a denial of his religious faith. Point 3D, idolatry. All the king's servants that were in the gate of the king, that is, all the court officials, were to kneel before Haman and bow themselves to the earth. It is obvious from this that Mordecai had declared to those who asked him the reason he did not fall down before Haman that he could not do so because he was a Jew. And that as a Jew, he could not commit idolatry, showing that honor to man, which was due to God alone. Josephus says, foreigners and Persians worshipped Haman as commanded that such an honor should be paid to him. When Haman understood that Mordecai was a Jew, he had indignation and said to himself that where the Persians, who were free men, worshipped him, Haman, this man, who is no better than a slave, does not. We recall other Jews, Daniel and his three friends, with another king, Nebuchadnezzar, would not commit idolatrous worship on pain of death by fire and death by lions. Mordecai must obey God rather than men and leave the consequences to him. We recall Acts 5, verse 29. We ought to obey God rather than man. So it appears bowing down was such kind of Persian reverence to a man and worship of him, which was contrary to Mordecai's conscience, to God's law of idolatry. Such an attitude of profound reverence was and is due only to God. Point 3E, Amalekite. There's another reason for Mordecai's not bowing down to Haman. God said, and I'll read Deuteronomy 17, verse 17. Remember what Amalek did to you. You will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. JFB says, Haman, being an Amalekite, one of a doomed and accursed race, was doubtless another element in the refusal of Mordecai to bow down to him. Adoration required of Mordecai to Haman was too much like the adoration due only to God, as Josephus seems to think. Mordecai may have thought he ought to pay no sort of adoration to an Amalekite, which nation had been such great sinners as to have been universally devoted to destruction by God. JFB says, Haman knew Jews were sworn enemies of his countrymen, the Amalekites, and got the king's sanction of the intended massacre of the Jews. Though Christianity by no means destroys good manners, but teaches us to render honor to whom honor is due, Yet, in the eyes, such a vile person as Haman was is despised. I'll read Psalm 15, verse 4. Psalm 15, verse 4. In whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. So, Mordecai, being a Jew, was unlikely to even honor Haman, an Amalekite who loved what God hated, including idolatry. Where Saul could not kill Agag, Mordecai kills Haman. Where Saul took the booty of Amalek, Mordecai does not allow the Jews to, quote, lay a hand on the plunder, unquote, Esther 9:16. Point four, Ahasuerus. Point four, King Ahasuerus. Seven subpoints. Subpoint 4a. Just who is Ahasuerus? Ahasuerus is the Hebrew form of the name, of which the more commonly known Greek form is Xerxes. And Xerxes is the name used in the NIV Bible, including Book of Esther. It was a common title of the Medo-Persian kings. The modern title Shah comes from a king, which forms the latter part of the name. The former part is akin to Shur, a lion. Therefore, Lion King. Scholars generally agree that the well-known Xerxes, 486 to 465 BC, the son and successor of Darius the Great, is undoubtedly the Ahasuerus or Xerxes of the Book of Esther. I'll hereafter normally use Xerxes. Point 8, 4b, timeline. Timeline. Xerxes reigned 21 years, 486 to 465 BC, namely 23rd December 486 BC to 16th of December 465 BC. Xerxes' father, Darius, had left to his son, Xerxes, the task of punishing the Greeks for their interference in the Ionian Rebellion and the victory of Marathon. So, first 3 years, 486 to 483 BC, Xerxes prepared a great fleet and army to punish the Greeks for aiding the Ionian cities in 498 BC and for their victory over the Persians at Marathon in 490 BC, and partly for imperial expansion. Xerxes prepared his expedition with great care. Two bridges were thrown across the Hellespont. Xerxes, in his third year, had lavish feasting, which we read of in Esther, described, during which Vashti was deposed. In this third year of Xerxes, at this great six-month feast and assembly in Shushan, the palace, council was held when Xerxes arranged the Grecian War, Herodotus 7-8. Xerxes held this council to prepare and arrange for invading Greece. During the 180 days, 6 months, Xerxes discussed war plans with his subordinates and overawed them with the opulence and grandeur of his court. Thereafter, approximately 481 BC, Xerxes led the expedition against Greece, foretold, prophesied in Daniel 11, verse 2. I'll read Daniel 11, verse 2. Quote, by his strength, through his riches, he, that's Xerxes, shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. Unquote. Xerxes led this invasion of Greece with an army, it is said, of more than 2 million soldiers, only 5,000 of whom returned with him. The Greek historian Herodotus gives as the combined strength of Xerxes' land and naval forces the incredible total of 2,641,610 warriors. 480 BC, in Greece, at the Battle of Thermopylae, Leonidas, Spartan king, with his famous 300 Spartans and others, fought to the death, delaying Xerxes' progress. Thermopylae was a narrow track about 50 feet wide passing under a cliff. With the sea on one side and high cliffs on the other, the pass was a strategic defense position. According to Herodotus 7-102, Xerxes watched the Battle of Thermopylae sitting upon his throne. Leonidas and his 300 Spartans and others heroically died to delay Xerxes, buying time for Greece. The Persians, with help from a Greek traitor, wiped out these Greek defenders and went on to take and burn Athens, which had been abandoned. Thereafter, Xerxes was defeated disastrously by Themistocles with the Greek navy at Salamis, 480 BC. Plutarch says Xerxes also watched the battle of Salamis sitting upon his throne. So Xerxes' great expedition against Greece culminated in the defeat of the Persian forces at Salamis, 480 BC, and Plataea, 479 BC. The Greeks' victory threw the Persian Empire into a state of languid torpor from which it could not rise again. Xerxes was the Persian king who imposed a stated tribute, Esther 10, verse 1, on the provinces, voluntary presents having been customary before. The tribute which he, quote, laid upon the land and upon the isles of the sea, Esther 10, verse 1, was probably to replenish his treasury exhausted by the Grecian expedition. In the 7th year of his reign, Xerxes returned defeated from Greece and consoled himself in the pleasures of his palace and harem. Xerxes offered a reward for the inventor of a new pleasure, Herodotus 9-108. 478 B.C., Xerxes' seventh year, replaced Vashti, deposed 4 years earlier by marrying Esther, the beautiful Jewish chosen as his queen, after gathering all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan. 478 B.C., so it was after his return from the disastrous Greek invasion that Esther was chosen as his queen. So Esther, Jewish orphan, became queen of Xerxes. Xerxes, in some respects, was the greatest of the Persian kings. Point 4C. Xerxes' personality. 4C, Xerxes' personality. Nelson says, the picture of Ahasuerus presented in the Book of Esther, the vastness of his empire, his riches, his sensuality and feasting, and his cruelty and lack of foresight is consistent with the description of Xerxes provided by the Greek historian Herodotus, a 5th century B.C. Greek historian, who said Xerxes was vain and sensual. Fawcett says, his character, which resembles that of Xerxes, as described by the Greek historians, proud, self-willed, impulsive, amorous, reckless of violating Persian proprieties, ready to sacrifice human life, though not wantonly cruel. Xerxes scourged the sea and killed the engineers because his bridge over the Hellespont was swept away by the sea. Xerxes decreed the massacre of the whole Jewish people to please his favorite, Haman. JFB says of his character, despotic, capricious, fickle, reckless of human lives, and immersed in sensual pleasures. The king's utter indifference to the fate of millions of his subjects has found modern parallels in Hitler and Stalin. Matthew Henry says, when he found himself fixed in his throne, pride of his heart, rising with the grandeur of his kingdom, he made a most extravagant feast. This was vain glory, an affection of pomp. If he'd shown the riches of his kingdom and the honor of his majesty, as some of his successors did, in contributing largely towards the building of the temple and the maintaining of the temple services, it would have turned to much better account. Point 4D. God moved the heart of King Xerxes. God moved the heart of King Xerxes. God's hand and influence are repeatedly worked in the mind of King Xerxes. Let's turn to Proverbs 21, verse 1. Proverbs 21, verse 1. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. Like the rivers of water, he turns it wherever he wishes. During a sleepless night, Xerxes sent for his royal records to read of how the Jew Mordecai, Esther's guardian, had uncovered a plot to kill the king and thus had saved his life. Xerxes' discovery led to Mordecai's being raised to a position of honor in the kingdom. God put it into the heart of Xerxes to call for this rather than music or songs, which Persian kings used to be attended with. We also compare, I'll read, Daniel 6, verse 18. Daniel 6, 18. Daniel saved from the lions. Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no musicians were brought before him. Also, his sleep went from him. Point 4E, Law of Medes and Persians. Point 4E, Law of Medes and Persians. No one, not even the king of Persia himself, had the power to reverse the law of the Medes and Persians. We compare a similar plight of Darius the Mede in Daniel 6, verse 8, where Daniel was sent to the lion's den. Matthew Henry says, if the king were indeed, as he seemed to be, troubled by such a decree was made, he could do no less than to revoke it. For what is repentance but undoing to the utmost of our power what we've done amiss? This was a fundamental article of their Magna Carta, that no law or decree, when once it had passed the royal assent, could be repealed or recalled, no judgment vacated or reversed. I'll read Daniel 6, verse 15. Daniel 6, 15. Then these men approached the king and said to the king, know, O king, that this law of the Medes and Persians, that no decree or statute which a king establishes may be changed. This is so far from speaking wisdom and honor of the Medes and Persians that really it speaks of their pride and folly, and consequently their shame. It's ridiculous in itself for any man or company of men to pretend such an infallibility of wisdom as to foresee all the consequences of that which they decree. Therefore, it is unjust and injurious to mankind to claim such a supremacy of power to make their decrees irrevocable, whether the consequences prove good or bad. It is God's prerogative not to repent and to say what can never be altered or unsaid. Point 4F, Vashti. Vashti. Realizing that the restoration of Vashti would spell doom for them, the princes abandoned the precedent of providing a queen from among their own daughters and suggested the king choose a new queen from among the most beautiful virgins in the empire. To prevent, then, a return of affection for his rejected queen wife ensuing, a circumstance which might greatly endanger all who had concurred in effecting her repudiation, the servants of the king, i.e., the court officials who were about him, said, let there be young maidens, virgins, fair to look on, besought for the king. Thereupon, Xerxes indignantly divorced Vashti and published a royal decree asserting the superiority of husbands over their wives. he sent letters to all his provinces to make known his commands and to let all husbands know that they were to bear rule in their own houses. Following a 2-year search for Vashti's replacement, Xerxes chose Esther as his queen. He divorced his queen Vashti for refusing to appear in public at the banquet and married 4 years afterwards the Jewish Esther, cousin and ward of Mordecai. Point 4F. One half the kingdom. One half the kingdom. Matthew Henry says, Xerxes twice inquired of Esther, "What is your petition?" And his generous promise that it should be granted even to the half of the kingdom, a proverbial expression by which he assured her that he would deny her nothing in reason. Herod used it. I'll read Mark 6, verse 22 to 28. Mark 6, 22 to 28. And when Herodias' daughter herself came in and danced and pleased Herod, and those who sat with the king said to the girl, "Ask me whatever you want, and I will give it to you." He also swore to her, "Whatever you ask of me, I will give you, up to half my kingdom." So she went out and said to her mother, "What shall I ask?" She said, "The head of John the Baptist." Immediately she came in with haste to the king and asked, saying, "I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter." And the king was exceedingly sorry. Yet, because of the oaths of those who sat with him, he did not want to refuse her. Immediately, the king sent an executioner and commanded his head be brought, and he went and beheaded him in prison. He brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl, and the girl gave it to her mother. To offer half the kingdom, far from wisdom and honor, speaks of pride and folly, and consequently shame. Let us beware what we say. Point 5, Esther. Esther's Hebrew name was Hadassah, which means myrtle. I'll read in Esther 2, verse 7. Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, that is to say, his cousin, for he had neither father, she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. On her introduction to the royal harem, Hadassah's name was changed to the Persian Esther, a star, indicating beauty and good fortune. Esther was the daughter of Abihail, a Benjamite, uncle of Mordecai, and therefore was Mordecai's cousin. Esther was Mordecai's cousin, notwithstanding Josephus and various commentaries which incorrectly term Mordecai as uncle. Their ancestor, Kish, a Benjamite, today Norway, had been among the captives led away from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. Left an orphan, Esther was adopted and brought up by Mordecai, her cousin, after the death of her parents. Mordecai held an office in the palace at Susa. Character. What are some character traits we see in Esther. Let's turn to 1 Peter 3, verses 1 to 6. 1 Peter 3, verses 1 to 6, for some of her traits. Submission to husbands. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of their wives. When they observe your chaste conduct, accompanied by fear, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel, but rather let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. Fawcett says, Esther's character is attractive, dutiful to her adoptive father, and regardful of his counsels, even as a queen, having faith and believing with Mordecai that even if she held her peace at the crisis, deliverance would arise to the Jews from another place, and that Esther had come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Brave, yet not foolhardy, but fully conscious of her peril, not having received the king's call for 30 days, with pious preparation, seeking help from God, and subsequently, quote, obtaining favor in the sight of all of them that looked upon her, Esther 2, verse 15. JFB says, Esther has great tact, and the variety of expressions by which she describes her willing submission to her royal husband, using wisdom and skill. As soft answers turn away wrath, so soft askings obtain favor. Unger says, the character of Esther, a woman of deep piety, faith, courage, patriotism, and caution, combined with resolution, a dutiful daughter to her adopted father, who we note was actually her cousin, docile and obedient to his counsels, and anxious to share the king's favor with him for the good of the Jewish people. Esther was a virtuous woman, and as far as her situation made it possible, a good wife to the king. Her continued influence continued for a long time. There must have been a singular charm in her aspect and manners, since she obtained favor in the sight of all that looked on her. Esther is a woman of clear judgment, of magnificent self-control, and capable of the noblest self-sacrifice. We believe that Esther trusted God and was therefore blessed by God, somewhat like Joseph and Daniel, who trusted and were blessed by God. Esther revealed a unique spirit in that she was not concerned to please the king by the outward adorning of plaiting of hair, of wearing of gold or putting on of apparel, but by the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. I'll read Esther 4, verse 16. Go, gather the Jews who are present in Shushan, and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, day or night. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. This is not of despair or blind fatalism or a hopelessness, but it's resignation. It's the perfect submission to God, a confidence in God's will and wisdom. I'll read 3 scriptures. First, compare Genesis 43, verse 14. Israel speaking, and may God Almighty give you mercy before the man, that he may release your other brother and Benjamin. If I am bereaved, I am bereaved. Second, compare Job 13, verse 15. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And third, compare Daniel 3, verse 17 and 18. Daniel's 3 friends. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O King. But if not, let it be known to you, O King, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the holy image which you have set up. And ending this point 5 on Esther with some romance that my wife Nancy enjoyed. From Josephus, Antiquities, Book 11, Chapter 6, reading. And thus Esther came to the king, and having a blushing redness in her countenance, with a pleasant agreeableness in her behavior, yet did she go in to him with fear. And as soon as she was come over against him, as he was sitting on his throne, in his royal apparel, which was a garment interwoven with gold and precious stones, which made him seem to her the more terrible, especially when he looked at her somewhat severely, and with a countenance on fire with anger, her joints failed her immediately out of the dread she was in, and she fell down sideways in a swoon. But the king changed his mind, which happened, as I would suppose, by the will of God, and was concerned for his wife, lest her fear should bring some very ill thing upon her. And he leaped from his throne and took her into his arms and recovered her by embracing her and speaking comfortably to her, exhorting her to be of good cheer and not to suspect anything that was sad on account of her coming to him without first being called, because that law was made for subjects, but that she, who was a queen, as well as he a king, might be entirely secure. And as he said this, he put his scepter into her hand and laid his rod on her neck on account of the law, and so freed her from fear. And after she recovered herself by these encouragements, she said, "My lord, it is not easy for me on the sudden to say what has happened, for soon as I saw you to be so great and comely and terrible, my spirit departed from me, and I had no soul left in me." Point 6. Esther, later on. Esther, later on. Sources include Good News, February 1961, Is Judaism the Law of Moses? Also, Norbert Link Sermon, 2nd December 2006, Ezra and Nehemiah, Part 2. 604 to 585 BC, Babylonian King Nebuchadnezzar, conquered Judah and carried away most Jews to Babylon, including Esther and Mordecai. Also, Daniel and his three friends. Isaiah had prophesied 200 years prior, Cyrus, by name, king of Persia, would overthrow Babylon. Isaiah 45, verses 1 to 4. Cyrus did, in 539 BC, impressed by Isaiah's exact prophecy concerning himself, Cyrus decided to honor this god, resulting in his edict that some of the captive Jews could return and rebuild the Jerusalem temple of God. First return of the Jews. However, with lax progress, many years later, 457 BC, Persian king Artaxerxes, in his seventh year, issued notable royal decree, Ezra 7, verse 25, referenced in the 70 weeks prophecy in Daniel chapter 9. So, 457 BC, God directed priest Ezra, with Artaxerxes' royal decree granting him power, to go to Jerusalem and beautify the temple and establish services and teach God's law. In other words, Ezra was going to Jerusalem not only to be a priest of God, to reestablish religious worship, but also to establish law and order by rebuilding Jerusalem as a Jewish capital city. 457 BC was about 25 years after Esther became queen in Babylon, that Ezra the scribe and priest, a direct descendant of Aaron, left Babylon with the blessing of the king Artaxerxes, stepson of Queen Esther. This was the second return of the Jews. Ezra brought with him about 1,750 males. His purpose was to teach God's law and to beautify the temple, which had been completed 60 years earlier. Why was Artaxerxes, king of Persia, so interested in the Jews' religion, and why did he want Jerusalem to be rebuilt and inhabited? The answer is plain. Esther, a Jewish, had been queen of Persia, and Mordecai, her cousin, prime minister of the kingdom. Esther, we know, had been married to King Xerxes, Hebrew Ahasuerus, who ruled 486 to 465 BC, and was the father of Artaxerxes. Thus, the king under whom Ezra was appointed to rebuild Jerusalem was Artaxerxes I, son of Xerxes. Esther was probably still alive 25 years later when Ezra in 457 BC, and another 13 years later when Nehemiah in 444 BC went from Babylon to Jerusalem to help rebuilding Jerusalem. Esther was still undoubtedly the queen mother when Ezra left for Jerusalem in 457 BC. Thus, likely, there was considerable Jewish influence in the king's palace at this time. Esther, at the time of Nehemiah, perhaps 60 years old, an influential person in the palace, having been the wife to Xerxes and being the stepmother to Artaxerxes, the king of Persia, under whom Ezra and Nehemiah went to Jerusalem. So probably through Esther, Artaxerxes was favorable towards the Jews. Impressive how God works things out. Last point seven, 12 things we can learn from Esther. 12 things we can learn from Esther. Number one, God cares for his people and us individually. God cares for his people and us individually. Most commentaries overlook what may well be the actual intent of the book of Esther, to teach God's care of his people. God's unseen hand guides, directs, and preserves his people by working out circumstances, often in most unexpected ways. God's always there, working behind the scenes. There are times we've questioned events in our lives and wondered where God was. God's hand is not only guiding prophetic events, but also when we strive to live his way, working out circumstances in our individual lives. God is in total control of events and is working out all things for the good of his people. Number two, God uses events and people to his purpose. God uses events and people to his purpose. The story of Esther's rise from an unknown Jewish girl to become queen of the world's greatest power illustrates how God uses events and people as instruments to fulfill his promise to his chosen people. Same applies to us as Christians. The book of Esther shows how God's divine guidance, God's hand, overrules all things. Even in a distant, far country, God's people are yet in his hands. Esther was raised up an instrument in the hand of God to avert the destruction of the Jewish people and to give them protection and provide peace in their captivity. Number three, Jewish nation saved. Jewish nation saved. Jewish nation experienced one of the greatest deliverances of God since the Exodus. Yearly at Purim, Jews must always remember how God saved them. Number four, Amalekites and Haman. Amalekites and Haman. There's also a hidden plot in the story. Esther was a descendant of Kish from the tribe of Benjamin and a relative of King Saul. And Haman the Agite was descendant of King Agag of the Amalekites, who were nearly wiped out by Saul. Saul's reluctancy to do so cost him the throne of Israel in the eyes of God. The plot involves Haman's quest for revenge and Esther's redemption of Saul's mistake, saving the Jews from the Amalekites and certain extinction or genocide. Number five, origin of Purim. Origin of Purim. Esther contains the account of the origin of the Feast of Purim, one of two festivals adopted by the Jews that are not found in the Mosaic Law, the other being Hanukkah. Many activities are part of the Jewish celebration, including the reading of the law of the Book of Esther. During Purim, Jews remember how God saved them from their enemies. Point six, women of the Bible. Women of the Bible. God likely raised Esther to be queen of Persia because of the crisis he knew would arise through the wrath of Haman the Amalekite. Esther has a distinguished place among the women of the Bible. The great enemy of the Jews was destroyed, and Esther's people were delivered. Number seven, wives honor and obey their husbands. Wives honor and obey their husbands. In the king's letters, the king ordered that every man should rule over his own family. Then all the women will respect their husbands, from the least important men to the most important men. Number eight, fasting before God. Fasting before God. Fasting expresses the seriousness of the Jews and our concerns before God. In Esther's patriotic venture before the king, after previously fasting 3 days, God's interposing to incline the king's heart to hold out to her the golden scepter and ensuring to her at once her life and her request. Number 9, God's plan for us. God's plan for us. Esther was an orphan slave girl raised by her cousin Mordecai. God had a plan for the lives of Esther and Mordecai, and God has a plan for each one of us. Let's turn to Deuteronomy 31, verse 6. Deuteronomy 31, verse 6. Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid nor terrified because of them. For the Lord your God goes with you. He will never leave nor forsake you. Number 10, faithfulness rewarded. Faithfulness rewarded. So, when we get a little discouraged or can't understand why certain things happen, we can remember Esther. Faithfulness is rewarded. Number 11, pride before the fall. Pride before the fall. Poetic justice. The book of Esther teaches the law of retribution for sin by the hanging of Haman on his own gallows. Last, number 12, in danger, seek and fear God. In danger, seek and fear God. God wants us to learn and realize He is always in control. We need to stand for our godly convictions even in the midst of a dangerous situation. The book of Esther wonderfully shows God is in charge. In good times and in bad times, let us seek and fear God.